So please feel free to open things up for discussion and any kind of comment or questions people might have. Well, I think part of the, largely because of the whole quality of inquiry, which is so central to Buddhism, and one of the things that really has come out of the shrinking of the world and like global communications, is that, and also at the same time as the world was sort of getting connected up, it was also rationalism. Was increasing enormously, and the scientific inquiry and scientific method was being developed. So, by the time the end of the last century, the whole kind of scientific approach was very much sort of ingrained in European culture, and then theistic beliefs, particularly in Europe, were taking quite a hammering with Darwin and Freud and Marx. Also, there's an interesting thing, it crossed my mind to mention this anyway today, was that what happened was that the Vatican was so rattled by a lot of these sort of revolutions in the scientific world that they put together a think tank of their brightest minds. This is about 1900, between 1900 and 1910, they made a think tank of all their brightest minds. Theologians of one sort or another, and said, okay, well, here's all the information, this is what all the scientists are saying, here's all the scriptures, now you take this away and you tell us what you know, what you think. And so then 10 years later they came back and said, well, unfortunately, you know, they're right and you're wrong. And but that very quality of inquiry and research, and then actually, you know, the Vatican did redraw a lot of its things, like about the creation of the world and the sort of respect for the scientific approach and understanding to things like evolution. It shifted a lot at that time, and so that because as a culture we have a tremendous respect for that, looking into things, experimenting, testing, seeing how things work. That when Buddhism came on the scene, and there's so much within the teaching and the spirit of the teaching that is based around that very principle, and particularly the Kalama Sutta. I mean, I don't know how many times in different Western Buddhist texts I've seen the Kalama Sutta quoted as the Buddha saying, you know, don't believe what you hear just because it's traditional, because it's logical, or because it's handed down, or because it's coming from an authoritative teacher, but try it out and see whether it leads to goodness yourself. And then if it does, take it and use it. But that is just so totally in accord with the whole Western scientific rationalist mode that it kind of fits perfectly into the spirit of the time. But yet, in the same breath, it also has the essential qualities of religion, of spirituality contained within it as well. So that, in a way, they're offering a religion which is both the essence of spirituality, but also that essence is arrived at through a methodical analysis and inquiry and personal experimentation and investigation. You know, those elements. And people want truth. People want to know. People want to understand. They want peace. But if you can't believe, if you haven't got faith, then the only way you can arrive at faith or confidence is through your own experimentation. So then, with Buddhism offering both that, you know, a path of inquiry, but also then the result of it being, you know, spiritual wholeness, rather than just, you know, an efficient infrastructure, then it fits so perfectly into the Western culture in these times.
I read recently that there's said to be a holy, very holy imam in Saudi Arabia who was recently appointed to some important position. who has declared that the Holy Quran says the earth is flat, so anybody who disagrees with that is a heretic.
Well, then, but it's also it's interesting though that you know in these times that someone can say something like that, and that and yet the and but the, most people in the world will say, well, that's just a religious nut, you know, who obviously has great faith, but you know their ideas would not be taken seriously. It's just like the Dalai Lama was very, very upfront about that. When people said, "Well, how much should you believe the scriptures?" He said, "Well, you know, you should take what is meaningful and disregard what's not meaningful." He said, "For example, you know, in the scriptures it says that the world has got this huge mountain, Mount Meru, at the center," and he said, "But you know, you talk to a geologist and they'll tell you it's rubbish." So I'm quite prepared to ignore that. And so that. And so there were then within the minds of this particular culture that would make sense, and be reasonable, be meaningful. So then you wouldn't think this is a religious nut. This is someone who's into religion, but also is ready to accommodate different ways of understanding reality.
Would you say the breaking down of barriers is that? Exactly say what you mean directly. I'll give you an example. On Radio 2 Good Morning Sunday, recently, Don McLean has been interviewing Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, you see. And there was one letter, actually from somebody in my own denomination, the Congregational Federation, was saying that those people who condemn Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons are just like the Pharisees. And he also said that they really love the disciples who were quarrelling about the first, who's going to be the first in the kingdom of heaven. Now, she was obviously saying that these Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, are fellow Christians. But saying it in a roundabout way, would you say that that would be likely to make the other person think and therefore generate more tolerance than if the letter was written? These people now are mind you, about time they realise that Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons are fellow Christians, etc.
Yeah. I mean, you always want to express yourself in a way that incorporates or doesn't kind of cast blame or negativity. I mean, it's good to point out that which is foolish or is destructive, but you never want to kind of criticize people, you know, in themselves. So it's like to say when you're speaking of other traditions or other people, I feel quite happy to say something like, well, I can't really say that I think the same way that you do, but I certainly respect your right to think in your own way. And also the fact that you can love someone completely and also feel that their opinions are complete rubbish. You know, it's just the two things don't have to match. It's just like if someone that you know, someone that you love very dearly goes crazy, or you know, or when who starts to lose their faculties and they can't, you know, they can't think straight or express themselves clearly, or they get sort of paranoid delusions. You can still feel great friendliness and affection for them, but you know that the communists are not hiding in the bottom of the teapot. You know, it's just, but by the fact that you don't believe them or go along with them, you don't have to say, don't be an idiot, of course, you know, that's not true. You can find a way to express your affinity with people without defying their reality. If it's something they're absolutely convinced of, then it's, you leave that to them. You don't need to oppose it. I mean, it's quite an art. But there was an interesting incident that happened a few years ago. There was a large interfaith gathering that was happening at a Chinese monastery in the States, in California, and some local fundamentalist Christians took great exception to this meeting happening, and So they were picketing the gate of this monastery. They were standing outside with placards, and when people started arriving for the conference, and all the time through the conference, they were around. But anyway, when the conference was opening up, and then the monks and nuns in the monastery came up to the master and said, "Oh dear, master, it's terrible. You know, these Christians are ruining the whole thing. They're standing out there. They're barricading the gate. They're standing there with their placards. You know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear." And he said, "Oh, well, let me go and talk to them." So then he went down to the gate and met the people. And it was quite a large conference, and people had come from all over the States and Europe to come to it. And then he went down to the people at the gate and said, "Well, this is a Christian Buddhist conference, and you're Christian, so we'd like to invite you to come and participate in the conference." And you know, it's very wrong of us to have forgotten to have not invited you. So you know, please, we'd like to welcome you in, and we'd like you to participate in this conference. We'd like to hear what you have to say, because we feel it's very important to listen to everyone. So anyway, he invited them in, and throughout the conference, which was you know 3 or 4 days long, these people were really making a scene, and you know, all these kind of like the sort of talk I gave this afternoon would have been absolutely hammered. And they would keep getting up and objecting to things, or testifying, as they say, in the so you could see that everyone was in the comment, "Oh God, this is terrible. I don't really like this." It was very uptight and uncomfortable with the whole thing. But things sort of smoothed out over a couple of days, and they developed a certain sort of friendliness and acceptance of each other. And finally, things were quite chummy by the end. And throughout the conference, the abbot of the monastery hadn't spoken or hadn't got up to give a talk. And so finally, it was the final address, and it was time for the abbot to speak. So he got up on the stage, and he said, "I would like to ask you all a question." And then he said, "And the question I want to ask is, whose religion is the best?" They're like, "Oh God, no! Oh no, please, not that." "Who's got the best religion?" And he has a very piercing look, and he looked around and says, "Whose religion is best?" And then he said, "Your religion is best. Because if your religion wasn't best, you'd just change it for another one, wouldn't you?" And then he gave this wonderful talk about how, you know, each one of us chooses our own religion. And that even though we might think of ourselves as a Christian or a Buddhist, you know, each one of us is actually has our own religion, and that we inherently feel that we're right, because if we weren't right doing that, we'd do something else. And so that the whole point is not in terms of how right we are, or how strong our faith is in what we know, but how much we can trust that certainty. You know, if our faith in that is complete, then we'll be able to be in harmony with others. If our faith in that is not complete, then we need to defend ourselves against others, because others are a threat. And if others are not a threat, then we don't need to defend ourselves. And so then there's a quality of human friendliness and warmth. And that this is, he said, you know, what we're trying to do as Buddhists is not, we're not trying to promote Buddhism. That's not our goal. You know, we are Buddhists, but we're not trying to promote Buddhism. What we're trying to promote is human virtue. Is we're trying to promote goodness. And interesting, the Dalai Lama said exactly the same thing a number of times, that when he was it was proposed to him that you know, the fundamental duty of Buddhists was to spread the Buddha Dharma. He said, "No, that's absolutely wrong." And people can look in the audience, looked shocked. He said, "No, that's absolutely wrong view." He says, "No, we're not here to promote Buddha Dharma. What we're trying to do is to promote compassion and kindness. That's our first duty as Buddhists. Buddhism comes second. Kindness and compassion comes first." And I think it's in that spirit, if that priority is there, then our Buddhism will flourish and we'll actually be practicing Buddhism in a much more complete and full way than if we're kind of waving our Buddhist flag furiously and using that as a kind of identity that we just a thing that we want to belong to that makes us feel secure because we belong to something. You know, it's just like supporting Liverpool Football Club or the Labour Party or whoever. You know, it's just you want a true religion needs to be something more than just a tribe that we belong to. What is the symbolism of the dragon? Well, it's a mixture, actually. It's just a kind of mythical beast, like a chimera. It has the tail of a fish, the feet of a horse, the body of a snake, the horns of a deer, and I think the nose of an elephant. So, but you see, it doesn't look very confused. So it's happy in its diversity. It's one of those things that arrive in Buddhist monasteries that no one knows quite what to do with. But it sits there and happily exists, entire unto itself. Yes.
What you're saying in the first half seems to quite a lot around the difficulty we have when we want to use our own words and other people's words are different than what we mean and so on. And yet at the same time you're saying the fruits of all these different things seem to be pointing to the same sort of thing. Good person from anyone.
Mm.
Is it something to do with the fact that we just don't seem to be able to live with not knowing that we can't recognise or we seem to that there's something ineffable? The problem is that we need to sort of nail it there.
That's the main problem. Yeah. That's it's the drawback. I mean, just as rationalism in the West has brought this quality of inquiry and a real sort of a deep and personal search into spirituality, it's also brought, on the other side of it, the coin, this sense that reality can be described in terms of words and numbers. And which is a disaster, because and even though a certain amount of reality can be described in that way, and you can actually, in accumulating knowledge of that sort, you can actually make life function very smoothly. I mean, like you can hear amplified sound, you have double glazing, all the sort of marvels of the technological world have come out of kind of refined conceptual thought, but equally that the kind of deduction that then that can, if you just keep thinking hard enough and long enough, you'll think of everything, is a tremendous delusion. And so that but we don't really have very many models in our education or in our society that says it's all right to not know. Because to not know is a weakness, right? Someone who's knowledgeable, who's a great thinker, is a rich person. They have clout, they have a kind of strength and importance. And to not know something is a kind of weakness. It's like a poverty. How many times can you say about something, I don't have an opinion about it? When people say, what do you think about this? Or what do you think about the election? What do you think about this, that, or the other? We always have an opinion, don't we? And to say, I don't have an opinion, I don't care, is like, whoa, what's wrong with you? Right? It's like you're not participating. If you don't have an opinion, it means that you are being dismissive towards us. You're not participating in our reality. And to say, or if someone asks you about something, to say, I don't know, rather than coming up with a guess or an idea or a bluff, it, again, it's a kind of weakness. And because if we don't know, we'll always guess or come up with something. And to say, you know, I don't know, and then I don't care, is like socially unacceptable. And, you know, I have a kind of, you know, I grew up as a know-all, you know. So I speak with a certain sort of personal involvement in this whole question. And I always had an answer for everything, and if I didn't, I'd bluff. And, or just lie, you know. And then it became, as I got into Buddhist practice, it became clearer and clearer, and I began to notice around me, and also within Buddhist teachings, that sense of, and particularly, you know, certain Buddhist teachers were talking about this, how to actually say, I don't know, is the most realistic response to the experience of life, most of the time. And then you begin to see that rather than thinking, you know, I know, and having the whole kind of life, the universe and everything figured out and labelled, you realise that actually you've got a kind of a handle on about 1% at the middle of the picture, and the rest is just who knows what. It sort of dissolves off into the periphery, but there's this little sort of a few things that, you know, in the centre of the picture that you can kind of talk about. But the rest you don't really understand, you don't really know. So that I think somehow or other, as a culture, we need to bring in or to introduce the idea that it's quite okay to not know or to not have an opinion. Which doesn't mean to say I don't care, but just that you know, I am not involved in that question. I'm not picking up that question. Because oftentimes, like if I ask you a question, or you ask me a question, oftentimes we'll automatically respond to the question in terms of the way the question is phrased. But how often does someone say to you, well, that's not the right way to ask the question, or that question doesn't make sense? We won't do that. But a lot of the time that's true, because every question has a whole gang of assumptions with it. So, and I think for myself this has been a tremendous, tremendously noticeable aspect of the Buddhist practice in myself, is to be able to say, I don't know. And to be at peace with not knowing. And that, and in fact, rather that you realize that the need to believe something is based around the fear of the unknown. And the unknown is frightening as long as there's a sense of self. The stronger the ego is, then the more the unknown is threatening. Because, you know, if I'm here, then out there it could be anything. But the less strong the ego, the less strong the sense of self, then there isn't an in here and an out, there's less of an in here and an out there. It's all this. Like I was saying before, there isn't a them and an us, there's just us. So that then the less of a self-centeredness there is, the less that the unknown is frightening, it's just mysterious. And so then the unknown is met with a feeling of a quality of wonder, wonderment, rather than intimidation. So that ability to, like I was talking about earlier, that, you know, when you're faced with these questions, like, is there a God or is there no God? You know, I've got to know. You know, you realize, well, is there a God is a question. Whether it's a meaningful question or not is another thing. You can say, well, that's a question. Or is there no God? That's a question. You know, what really happens? What is, you know, what is life? And so you realize that by allowing the question, just to recognize that's a question, then, and the mind is open to that, we're beginning to tap into a whole level of intuition. Because our heart understands life. You know, our heart understands Dhamma, the true reality of things. But sometimes our thinking can just get in the way of that. And we're trying so hard to get to figure it out that our thinking gets in the way. Actually, during this Christian Buddhist conference, I was doing a reading out of a book of talks by a Christian monk called Brother David Steindl-Rast, and this particular passage impressed me so much that I asked someone to copy it out for me, and I thought it might crop up. This area might crop up today, so I thought I might read this out. It's on this very question. He's describing the like the source of religion as something that every human being is familiar with, that all of us have have experienced many times, some kind of experience of clarity, of stillness, of kind of purity of being. And it can be in the most insignificant, what we think of as the insignificant moment. I mean, he actually describes it of a time when he and his two brothers, when they first immigrated to America, and they, his younger brother was running the hot and cold water into the bath, and he called out from the bathroom, "Wow, come and look at this!" And then he said he and his two brothers stood there over the bath, watching the play of light and shadows as the hot and the cold water mixed together, and they were just completely enraptured. He said it was like every time everything stopped. He said he realized that was that was a religious experience. And so he's using this, he's talking about these as that kind of clarity as and stillness as something that's completely universal, common to all human beings, and how this relates to what we think of as religious questions. At the peak of our peak experience, everything suddenly makes sense. Your heart is touched and there is peace. Not that suddenly you found answers to all your questions. Not that all contradictions are suddenly reconciled. Not even your problems are solved. But you have hit upon something deeper than questions, more comprehensive than all contradictions. Something that can support all problems without need for solutions. How strange. We usually think that we must trace our questions to the ultimate question to arrive at the ultimate answer. We're convinced that we must work our way through contradiction after contradiction to arrive at an ultimate reconciliation, struggle with problem after problem to find the ultimate solution. Yet, what happened here is something entirely different. For one split second, we were distracted from our preoccupations with problems, questions, and contradictions. That child catching a minnow in a tide pool, that line of a melody, that flash in our lover's eyes, that did it. For one split second, we dropped the load of our preoccupations, and the super solution, the super answer, is suddenly ours, in one great super reconciliation of everything. What paradox! When I drop the question, there's the answer. In fact, we might begin to suspect that the answer is there all the time, trying to get through to us, while we are too preoccupied with our questions. But what disproportion between cause and effect! Why should one moment of true looking or listening yield what no amount of grappling with problems can wrestle from life? Our experience itself suggests an answer to this question. When we watch carefully, we notice that the child, the music, the loving glance teased us for a moment into saying yes to reality, a very special yes. We were caught off guard. Our heart went out to this tiny fragment of reality and burst into an unconditional yes. But having said this kind of yes to the humblest fringe of reality, we have implicitly affirmed all there is. By drinking deeply from the stream, we have said yes to the source. That is why our humble encounter is truly mystical, truly an experience of communion with ultimate reality. And since ultimate reality is the very coincidence of opposites, we should not be surprised if we experience this communion as paradoxical. Amazing, huh? In a way, it's like learning not to believe our thoughts. Which is not to say that all thoughts are worthless. But it's just to say, you know, all my thoughts can only be relatively true. All my opinions are a departure from reality. They are an opinion, like out on the wing. They are, and then if we begin to see in that way, then we can use our opinions, we can use our thoughts, and we can use our spiritual principles as a way of arriving at that yes. That in us which knows reality. And it's not as though any one of us can possibly be apart from that intuitive knowledge, because that's the very basis of mind. That's, you know, of all minds, you know, because it's very easy to think, well, maybe your mind, Bhante, but my mind's a mess. You know? Well, it's only the stuff on the surface which is messy, but that on which it is the surface of is not, you know, cannot be messed with, if you like. That is a fundamental quality of being. It's intrinsically pure. And so that that quality of knowing, clear seeing, it's a way of like dropping our thoughts or seeing through them to then recognize that which is prior to thought or beyond thought. And, you know, our culture just doesn't talk about that. We don't even have any symbols for it. Do we? I mean, I can't. Culturally, we just don't have, because there's no, you know, having lost our spiritual traditions, you know, having been weakened enormously, particularly in Britain, then that quality of the sacred or the ineffable is just laughed at. You know, religion is a kind of object of derision in our culture, largely. You know, a couple of people might sort of squeeze by us, sort of, like Mother Teresa or someone. But largely speaking, religion is something which is a bit of a joke. And so the culturally, we've kind of cut ourselves off from that quality of the sacred or the ineffable. We have no way of talking about it. And so that one has to just, in a way, like step outside the cultural forms. And that's why, you know, like you're saying earlier, that's why Buddhism and other Asian religions have aroused so much interest. Because if people aren't getting it, if you can't get it in the corner shop, you'll go around, you go to the other end of town. You know, if that's what you want, that's what you need, then you'll, wherever you can find it, you'll get it. You'll go there. Well, I think it that's true, but it's—I mean, there's different kinds of understanding. You know, the intuition is that you understand that you will never be able to conceptually understand that it's not the nature of the universe and life and the mind is never going to be under the control of the ego.
But to understand in this kind means to arrive to the border and to understand that there is something that is impossible, to surrender in the mystery.
That's it? Which is a tremendous... it's like an abdication, because the ego is so used to being in charge. it's a relief, but the ego doesn't often see the point. It doesn't like to lose its authority, and so, you know, when you try and say, you know, your time is up, then the ego will say, well, wait a minute, and doesn't want to surrender that kind of false sense of supremacy or reality. So that's what most of my experience of spiritual life, spiritual work is about, is like that kind of the the kind of not exactly battle, but the the tendency of the mind to either be dominated by the egoic concerns and the ego-centered, self-centered ways of thinking and seeing and feeling, and trying to break away from that conditioning and to live from that which is centered around, from, on truth and wisdom, compassion, so that. That I see as like the main area of spiritual work. So the main thing I find is that is to recognize the voice of the ego, to be able to recognize, you know, when we believe in our thoughts, when we meet our own preferences, our opinions, our habitual ways of seeing and thinking, to recognize, oh, wait a minute, this is an opinion. This is just what I think. This isn't necessarily true. I mean, it was a revelation to me when I first came in contact with Buddhism in Thailand, when one of the monks said that talking about thought and saying, you know, thought was a very untrustworthy thing, and I said I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, thought is extremely fickle and untrustworthy. I said, well. But and now my mind was completely sort of stymied by this, and it suddenly became clear to me in a flash that my entire life I'd always believed that everything I thought was true, and that other people were, you know, if they didn't think the same, if they thought the same as me, they were right. If they thought different from me, they were wrong. Very simple, you know. And if they just sat there patiently long enough, then they and I could explain it to them, they'd think the same as me, and then they'd be right. And then, and it suddenly became clear to me that was a complete idiocy. That was just a really stupid belief. And that, because the monk pointed out, well, look, do you think exactly the same as you did? Do you think the same now as you did 10 years ago? Are there things that you think now that you didn't think then? And I said, yes. Well, has your mind changed on certain things? I said, well, yeah. So, well, if you weren't right then, what makes you think that you're definitely right now, and that somebody else might not be right? And it was just like this incredible sinking feeling inside. Like, oh God, this is going to take a little while to work out, because I could see the whole sort of necessity to reorder my reality. Because I just had believed that thought was real and solid. I found out a few years ago. I actually seen the Rodin's sculpture, The Gates of Hell. It has the thinker, you know, Rodin's statue, the thinker. It actually it's right in the middle of the Gates of Hell at the top, in the center, top dead center of the Gates of Hell, is the thinker. Puts it in a slightly different context, and that readiness to recognize the limitations of thought and just to say, wait a minute, this is not ultimate reality, this is just, you know, thoughts going through my mind, to just remind oneself of that over and over and over and over again, then as soon as that reminding, that recognition happens, then the wisdom is right there every time. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, it's just like we can talk about language. I can say this is English, right? Now, relatively speaking, that's an accurate statement. This what I'm saying is English. So I'm talking about language. So that language can refer to itself. So in the same way thought can refer to itself, and on that level it's relatively true. But if I know that when I say, you know, thought is fickle, if I recognize that that's a relatively true statement, it doesn't mean to say that that has no use whatsoever.